Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Business Beyond Performance podcast. My name is Matt Powell. With me, as always, is my checkered past and checkered shirt co-host, Joe Staub.
Hey, gotta look good. This is a button down. I don't have the collar all tight, but still, nonetheless, look fly.
Man, you look fancy AF. So, super good show tonight. My big emphasis on tonight was going over soft skills. And the reason why I wanted to go over that was we got awesome Jesse Wright, former NBA strength coach, 76ers head of strength and conditioning, and head of performance actually for a few years near the end of his tenure there, where he would actually go in. He came out and wrote a book after he left the team, which is recently, I believe, within the last 18 months or so, and has actually written a book. It's more of a parable, really, about how a young strength coach goes through the ranks of a college setting and learns different stories from meeting different staff members and interacting with athletes. Joe, what'd you think of the book, man?
So I thought the book was awesome because, again, kind of like right time, right place, kind of like Ron McCreevy, CEO, strength coach, right time, right place. This book is right time, right place, because I feel like the industry at all performance, not just strength and conditioning, has gotten into this, you know, fake guru Instagram style where they really don't have the knowledge of what to do. And they also don't have the people skills and the soft skills to actually coach really well. So you're kind of like a fraud. There's a lot of frauds, a lot of big imposter syndrome. So I think for a lot of people out there who do have the knowledge, they have taken the time to learn. But what they haven't had, especially because of COVID, is that people side, the soft skill side. I think this is kind of that perfect book for people to get into that soft skill as we reset getting back physically together with people, to have those skills to then take their knowledge and step above some of those gurus and those frauds.
Looking back at your GA time, right? Because that was how it used to work, intern, GA, low-level assistant, and then hopefully, if things work out, work your way up or leave the profession. Looking back at your GA time or young coaching time, did you see a lot of yourself in the character that Jesse wrote about?
I did, actually. And it's funny, you know, in the moment, you don't recognize the goods and the bads. Obviously, you know, hindsight's 20/20. So one of the things we both had were good mentors who kind of forced us to reflect and force us. So almost every semester, I had a chance to kind of review my performance, you know, and learn. So, you know, you can only do that so much now, like, you know, decade and a half later, looking back, there's things I can still like, ooh, like I thought that was good, or I thought I learned this, but I didn't really get it. So reading his book was actually really fun for me because I'm just not in the business anymore. So kind of going back and pulling up some of those memories and pulling up some of those things and being like, damn, like, had I done it that way? Or like, yeah, if I was a little more chill, or had I not been as chill and actually stood my ground a little better, you know, all the different levers you can pull inter and intrapersonally, you know, it would have been nice to have this book 15 years ago.
100%, man. And obviously we want to push the book as much as possible. But even more so, Jesse as a human being was just so gracious with the time, the entire lead up to the interview, getting him onto the show. He was just, like I said, so gracious and continued to be knowledgeable and just show his hand and just offer to help any way possible. So just an awesome podcast guest and somebody that I'm looking forward to staying in touch with for a long period of time. But without any further ado, let's get Jesse Wright. Hey, everybody, welcome back. We're here talking with Jesse Wright, 13-year NBA strength coach who's slowly transitioning his way into the personal sector. Also an author, just came out with the book, The Attempt is to Grow, which is an absolutely fantastic book. He sent us the excerpt before it even came out a few weeks ago. Joe and I had a chance to kind of look it over. It looked absolutely fantastic. Had a couple acronyms in there. I'm going to have them break down for us later. Hopefully we'll keep it kid friendly. We'll see how that goes. No, but we're super excited to have him on here. Works for the Philadelphia 76ers. Also a fantastic person. And the biggest thing that he's working on now in the personal sector is to work on soft skills and helping young strength coaches and young sport coaches to work towards those skills and using them long-term to make the best career possible and reach the most athletes possible. So somebody I'm super excited, Jesse, welcome to the show.
I appreciate you guys having me. That was one heck of an intro. You're very, very well rehearsed at kicking these things off for sure. That was impressive.
I appreciate it. I usually let Joe do it just so he feels like important. Speaking of which, everybody, welcome Joe. Appreciate it for being my co-host.
My moment in the sunshine.
No, but it's fantastic to have you on. Jesse, actually, you and I go back to Temple days, obviously two different times, but fellow strength coaches that we had there and some good relationships. So super excited to have you. And you and Joe, actually, we were just talking about share your Hofstra connection as well. So give us a quick brief background, if you don't mind.
Yeah, interesting, like, you know, whether 6 degrees of separation or worlds collide, however you want to term that. It's funny what you unearth when you just start talking about, you know, paths traveled and all that stuff. I started off, you mentioned Temple. I started off as a student equipment manager at Temple for the football team. That was kind of like my first foray into elite, you know, kind of like high profile sports, right? Division I football. And, you know, just through that, you meet strength coaches, did some volunteer. I became an undergraduate assistant there for my second 2 years, and helped out with football, helped out with basketball, kind of was assigned my own teams. Didn't know what I was doing at the time, you know, no program design responsibilities, just, you know, young and eager. And they really took a chance on me when they didn't have to, and they hired me in place of a graduate assistant and just kind of helped me along the way. So that's kind of where I cut my teeth. I was young, and I say it all the time, probably not anywhere near ready, but, you know, I got a chance to start young. And then that led, I did my internship with the Philadelphia Eagles. I spent a season, close to a full year with them. And then they sent me to NFL Europe for a year. I was the head strength coach for the Barcelona Dragons. Again, another opportunity that was amazing, but probably one as a 23-year-old head strength and conditioning coach in the grand scheme of what it is you really need to be prepared to be a head strength coach for an NFL affiliate ball team. I was probably short of some of those, and probably, you know, maybe less about program design and the actual expertise that you would need to write an in-season training program, but definitely green and inexperienced in a lot of these, you know, quote unquote, soft interpersonal type skills that I just didn't have in my toolbox just yet. So that was Barcelona. That led to Hofstra University. I was a head strength coach for the football team that following season. And then I landed with an independent sports training company. We had as many as 4 training centers outside of the Philadelphia area at one point in time. And the owner of that facility is incredibly well networked in the sports landscape. He's an agent, represents a lot of high profile NHL players, a couple NBA guys. He signed 2 pretty high level contracts at the time. One was with St. Joe's University. So the company I worked for was their strength and conditioning resource, right? Instead of them hiring their own head strength coach. And then he signed a deal with the Philadelphia 76ers as well. And I was placed in different ways. I was placed within those contracts at different points in time and all that stuff. So my first 4 years with the 76ers were as a consultant working for that other company. And then after the 4 years, the team picked me up full time. So 14 total years in the NBA with the Philadelphia 76ers. 9 of those were as the head strength and conditioning coach. And then the last 5 were in a role titled Director of Performance Science. Was like a mixed bag of, you know, directly involved in nutrition and our dietitian and our culinary team, and, you know, did a lot of wearable technology, and I had some sports science responsibilities reporting to our director, and I assisted the strength and conditioning staff with things that they needed to kind of, you know, make sure they can run their room the right way. And it was really a very good support position to empower all of the other worlds that support the players the best way possible.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Shout out to Rob Smith, head strength coach at St. Joe's, another UConn guy who we all know, 6 degrees of separation in the strength world.
There you go. Absolutely. There's another one.
Absolutely. So one of the things that you brought up perfectly there was your final role with the 76ers. And I think that definitely helps to make you kind of an expert on the topic you're talking about tonight with soft skills. The ability to kind of go with that interdisciplinary look, right, and be able to talk to that dietitian, talk to that strength coach, then go talk to that athletic trainer, DPT, you know, physical therapist, whatever you want to call them, and then be able to go over to the sport coaches or the basketball coaches, you know, whatever position that's at, the bigs, the smalls, doesn't matter, and be able to communicate with all of them, and then put all of that together along with the data scientist on top of that is extremely important. And I'm sure you can probably tell us a little more about how to balance that and kind of how that prepared you to write this book.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. You just hit on a lot of like real practical, you know, call them challenges, call them day-to-day tasks, whatever it is. The communication piece in a team sport environment with all of these different interests that are all geared towards supporting the athletes and hoping leading to, you know, a winning season and healthy, robust, resilient athletes and everything. There's a lot of moving parts when it comes to team sport. And to really do it well, those moving parts need to communicate amongst each other. You just hit on a lot of them. If you just stay on the performance and medical side, which we termed athlete care for a lot of years with the 76ers, when we were at our best, we would begin our day with a meeting. And we would, as a team, with as many people that were available, sit in a room and talk about the day. And that day you would go over some of the medical issues. You might recap maybe what happened in the previous games, the previous night's game with respect to data. And of course the medical team would talk about any issues, anything that might've popped up over in a post-game eval or maybe even overnight. And all that led to maybe you're sitting there on a morning of a practice day. And then as a group, you're talking about what will we advise the coaching staff to do for practice today? Who may be in or out with a depth chart, and what is our projected loading look like with respect to where did we come from? How many games have we just played and how many games are coming up? And you want to solicit first and foremost a lot of opinions and experience from that room and then support it by data. And that's just that meeting. You come up with some type of agreement, you leave that room, and then that plan, right? And this is just going into a practice day. There's a lot of interested parties that need to know that type of plan, not the least of which is the coaching staff, which that would be your next step to go in and, you know, make the recommendation and align with what the goals and visions are for the coaching staff that day. But there's other people involved that would need to be communicated to pretty much all over the building with respect to what that is. And that's just one small example. That's just a practice day example. When you get into maybe the management of injury communication or something and all the necessary parties that need to know the updated status of an injured athlete, even going into maybe that athlete's individual camp with his agent and a business manager or something, and the path of communication to that as well. And then just the, you know, kind of the well-known medical / strength and conditioning link, where you guys are almost always speaking. Those two worlds are almost always speaking with respect to the athlete's needs, whether it's mobility or strength or injury risk reduction, or maybe something that the medical team learned in a pre-training evaluation that day and it's brand new info. Well, you better pass that over to your strength coaches so that they have the opportunity to do the right job and the most effective job that day. So that's tricky. And with a big staff, those challenges become even greater. And to kind of bucket all of this and to maybe tie a bow on it, like the system of communication, I think, is critically important within a high performance team environment. What is your structure? What is your system and the day-to-day identity of how you pass along information? If you just leave it to like informal chats and all that stuff, there's a good chance stuff will be missed. Although informal chats, right, can be effective sometimes. Maybe you can only have the time to grab somebody in a hallway for 2 minutes, but you better package your message pretty quickly if it's that. And what is your meeting structure? Have you set up a meeting time and environment that the major players can actually attend and be there? And you know, maybe there's software involved, right? And there's some type of app that you send information if you can't sit in a room and you can't grab somebody in a hallway, that you're constantly feeding information. And then you have your popular athlete management systems where you can share data and pull a bunch of different data sources into one where anybody can log on in their computer and, you know, pull up some information that way. So it can get pretty tricky, but the big message is to make sure you have systems in place that everybody that needs to be communicated to feels like they are.
So Jesse, you bring up a great point there. And the question I would have to follow up that is, how do you distill the voices to align the message? So what I mean by that, in the business I'm working with right now, we're rebranding the website. Mm-hmm. So I'm collecting feedback, right? Kind of what you said, you're collecting all this feedback, all these knowledge, experiences, these tidbits, but you still got to distill it down to an actionable plan within the set of tools that you have, right? So you use the resources of people and their expertise. Mm-hmm. You leverage the tools, but you still have to distill it down to a single message that everyone's aligned on. Because what you don't want to do is, we three of us are in a meeting, we're all talking, we come out of the meeting, I'm like, yeah, Jesse's going on that stupid PT stuff, and Matt just wants to lift them till they're strong, and I think you should be doing this, you know, because then all of a sudden, you know, it's Machiavelli, you know, you got the people who are pulling the strings, and things are changing, and the message starts to change. So how do you distill the voices to a single aligned message?
Mm-hmm. Well, you brought up a great point, because, you know, that staff meeting that I talked about that we would do as regularly as possible, without a doubt, you need to knock out and get rid of all your thumb wrestling in that room. You can have your arguments. And I would actually argue that you need to have those arguments, because there's a lot of firepower in those rooms. There's a lot of strong opinions, and those opinions are not always going to agree. And that's actually a good thing if you all disagree professionally and respect each other's opinions. However, you know, to use your word, distill, come together in that room and leave the room with a common message that athletes hear, that the coaches hear, that the front office hear. Otherwise, everybody's confused. Everybody hears different messages, and that doesn't help anybody. In fact, it actually does the other way, where no one knows who to trust, yep. Right? And it doesn't help any individual who might have their own interests or opinions. It doesn't help anybody once people are hearing conflicting messages on the outside. So you hit on a really critical topic, but it deserves to be repeated, because the common message theme is really important in a highly functioning, high performance environment. Now, how to get there, I think it starts with, number one, recognizing what was just said, right? You know, disjointed messages don't help anyone. So if there's a respect level for that, then everyone in the room at least has this intention that, like, hey, we got about 5 or 10 minutes left. We're still on opposite pages here. There's probably a leader in the room, right? Maybe it's your high performance director. Maybe it's somebody that's designated as the lead of the meetings, whoever it would be. But that person takes charge and says, guys, like, where are we on this? We have to come to some type of an agreement. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, maybe it's a little bit of give and take, or maybe it's, you know, hey, maybe we come to some type of compromise, or maybe sometimes the best decision, if it's not a critical decision, is, okay, let's table this, right? Let's just put this aside for a second and revisit it another time with maybe some different perspectives, or, you know, we can bounce it off somebody. You don't always have that opportunity, but sometimes maybe just punting it for a second might be the best way to arrive at a good decision later. So those are all pretty, I think, what could be effective strategies. And, you know, you see this in, you know, movies and, you know, on TV and everything, you know, you're seeing like the president, or maybe it's the CEO of a company, and you're soliciting a whole bunch of opinions. And at some point that person has to go, look, okay, thank you for all of your feedback, but I'm the boss, and here, this is the way we're going to go. And hopefully that person, that lead in the room, is number one, open-minded, maybe humble, maybe, vulnerable is probably not the right word, but either way is open to soliciting a lot of different opinions from a lot of areas, and then qualified and knowledgeable enough to take all of that information and arrive at what would be, you know, the most practical and effective solution. So I think that's the, you know, to me is the best way. I think you have to be open to hearing everybody, but funnel it in and get some lead in the room that says, cool, thank you, everybody. Here's what we're going to do. Let's make sure everybody is united as we leave this room. And then I think a big part of it, right, is your debrief, right? After your decision goes into execution, whether it's like immediately or it takes some time, I think it's really important to debrief and go look back at it and say, hey, what are our indicators if we made the right decision or not? And maybe sometimes that's like immediately noticeable, but maybe it does involve another part of people getting in a room and go, here's what I liked about it. Here's what didn't go. Here's when pear-shaped, right? And here's maybe when we're in this situation again, maybe we should look at it this way and maybe go down this path.
Yep. And always avoiding, you know, confirmation bias and, you know, sunk cost theory where people just do it because, you know, or the groupthink stuff. You know, mm-hmm. There's obviously the debrief, I think, you know, hitting on a key word is something a lot of people don't leverage well.
Yeah.
You know, they do stuff and they're like, yeah, or, but then they never reflect and internalize on the whys and the hows and, you know, can we take this lesson and apply it this way or change it a little and plug it here? Mm-hmm. So the next one,
powerful,
right?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but just a powerful question after whatever activity or initiative, whatever you were trying to decide on, is just, what did we learn? You know, and again, even if you're just bouncing off a couple people that were engaged in the initiative, it's like, okay, how did it go? What did we learn from that? You know, and it could be positive, could be negative, but, you know, guaranteed, particularly in a team sport environment, that scenario is probably going to come up again. You'd be better prepared for it, just having that little bit of conversation and review.
Nope, agreed. So I got one more follow-up on this. So I actually, post-coaching, right, we for people listening, this is the first time me and you have ever interacted, so you don't know me from a hole in the wall. Yep. So post-coaching, I consulted for both companies as well as executives and businesses, and that's kind of where I'm in now, totally outside of the athletic space. I actually work in the medical device world now. Okay. Totally, you know, I'm the director of marketing for a medical device remanufacturer. Totally other world. So one of the things that I always found that was huge is everyone has these, right? So, and I kind of, knowing your background a little bit, knowing kind of some people in the world, we know each other, I kind of know some of the successes and not, but I also know that there's a lot of people who've tried to implement these systems and they fail, because I've been actually brought in to help fix them and then build new ones. So what are some of the things you personally did or you saw another great leader do to help kind of fix or offset or control, depending on which way you frame it, when another person was trying to play the Game of Thrones and got a little off track with their messaging? So, you know, we come out of the meeting, we're all aligned, but then Matt starts to kind of water off and start to be that voice, you know, that little Tyrion Lannister Game of Thrones voice in the back of everyone's head, and he's causing problems. So that happens, right? That's people. So how did you deal? How did you watch someone deal with those things when someone started to be the negative influence and go awry?
Yeah. You know, I always go back to candor and transparency and hopefully, and those two things go really well when, and hopefully before that moment, and that happens, that there is a genuine opportunity to build relationships leading up to it, right? Maybe a foundation of trust, or at least a history of working together and everything. And I realize that's not always the case, but where I'm going with that, the candor and transparency part, I've always appreciated personally the real message. Don't sugarcoat, don't even the little Oreo sandwich, like, I'm going to give you a nice compliment, I'm going to hit you with the hard stuff, and then I'm going to leave you with a compliment and everything. Like, I personally have never needed that. I know other people are wired differently, but I've always appreciated just the real story. Just hit me with it, right? I'm thick skinned enough. I can handle that. I'm a big boy. And because of that, as difficult as it is in that moment, so now we're confronting your guy that strayed a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you, I think you have to have strong intel that he definitely did stray, because a lot of this is like whisper down the lane or secondhand info, like, hey, your guy, you know, he's off message, right? And, you know, you would definitely need to confirm that actually happened, to be fair. Mm-hmm. But if you had all that, it's just, to me, it's like hitting him like straight up and just going, hey, man, this isn't what we talked about. I've gotten some information that, you know, you were, again, off message, you know, whatever, we all agreed to something. And then, you know, we realized and found out that that wasn't necessarily the plan that you followed. And that's not right. Right. We all, you know we can't function that way. And to sit somebody in the room and just tell him very clearly, very succinctly what it is he did that, you know, either wasn't part of the team plan or that you personally would want to be corrected or something, I think that's always the best way to go. I think it's usually always backed up, if you can, best backed up by some type of objectivity, so that it doesn't end up being like an opinion versus another opinion, or here's what I thought versus you thought. Those conversations are hard. If you had some type of hard evidence or something, then you can actually go, well, hang on, this is what that is, right? That's helpful in difficult conversations for sure, if given that opportunity. But to me, I think you just got to, you know, you have to tell people like it is, and you have to be very clear about what, you know, not only what went wrong in this scenario, but again, if you have time and you live in a culture where those one-on-one conversations, both positive and constructive and negative, always occur, then you got a really good chance of having a positive end result of that. But, you know, the biggest part of that isn't in that this confrontational moment. The biggest part of that is the culture that you support, where everybody feels like they're speaking candidly, right? And we can be transparent with each other and we can speak openly. And that's the world that we all live in. And then that confrontation, right, is a little bit less, you know, confrontational.
Yeah. No, I love it. I'm going to finish a thought. I'm you know, taking notes, obviously. No rocket book tonight. I left it at work. I usually use a rocket book. I always plug them. I just love the product. They don't do anything for us yet. So just some of the things you said in the core philosophy to me, you know, there's hints of Stephen Covey. There's Patrick Lencioni. There's Ray Dalio. You know, you got truth, transparency, you know, openness, you know, Dalio's radical transparency at Bridgewater, where, you know, you film everybody and hey, it is what it is. So yep. I love the blend. You know, those are the people who I learn these ideas from. So mm-hmm. I love the blend of taking the bits and pieces, whether intentional or not. It's the right ingredient recipe list. So yeah. No, awesome. I think we're right on the same page, even though we don't know each other well. I think we're on the same page with a lot of things.
Another good one, and the author's name escapes me right now, is Radical Candor. It's got mm-hmm. a really powerful red cover. And she was, I believe, a high ranking executive somewhere in Silicon Valley. If it wasn't Google, it was one of those. I'm messing up some details here, but that is the title of the book. And what a great read with respect to this notion of leaders have to be able to function well and have difficult conversations, but they're not difficult if your culture is one that first and foremost you value people. And your employees or your athletes or whoever's under you know that you value them first as human beings, and that when you do have to have those confrontational moments or those correctable moments and everything, they don't come off as like this huge task or this huge, oh my God, I got to pull this person into an office and I got to read them the riot act and everything. It's just a continuation of another world where everybody is always just like, let's just tell the story. That's it. That's just how we are. Right. And it starts with people first. And then all of those kind of conversations are received much better when they know their bosses, superiors, leaders, or whatever value them as human beings first. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you guys are absolutely crushing it and brought up some amazing people for sure. I'm going to actually pull one real quick. But Fergus Connolly, when he was on this show with us, he actually said, it's the science of program or the programming, and then it's the art of people. And it sounds like you've started to really find a balance. And obviously, that's what you kind of gone on to. And with that transition in mind, tell us about the book. Tell us about what the goal of it was and what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, the purpose is, and I'm certainly not the first one to do this. What I hope to accomplish with the story is to continue to enhance awareness that to be a really impactful high-performance sport practitioner, and that's the world that we know, right? So it's directly applied to high-performance sport. But the cool thing about this concept and these interpersonal soft skills is that they cross over industries, they cross over leadership and members and, you know, bosses and employees and all that stuff. Like, everyone needs these to be good at what they do. And, you know, again, my story, the book that I wrote, happens to have, it's all contextual relative to a Division I university athletic department environment, right? So that's obviously going to lend itself well to people that are listening here and everything like that. But anybody that even has like just a little bit of ability of lateral thinking and likes doing that can easily apply it in their software world or their second grade teacher education world and everything, because the stuff all crosses over. So it's just this concept that who you are as a human is equally or arguably more powerful than what you know. These interpersonal soft skills, right? And there's a whole bucket of them. When you start digging into the people that have outlined these, the lists and the memes and all that stuff and everything, like, what I did with the book is just pull from this same bucket of soft skills, and they're all around leadership and communication and self-awareness and conflict management and cultural awareness and communicating up and communicating down and communicating across and, what defines you as a good teammate, your versatility and your adaptability and your ability to take on tasks and time management. It's all of these things that, again, there isn't a great term for it. Soft skills sucks. It's a really bad word for it. There's nobody in sport or anybody that really wants to raise to any level of achievement that likes the word soft, right? So interpersonal is good. People skills are good. Social skills good. It's fine. There isn't a really good term for it, but everybody knows them. But the funny thing is that the common, the conventional high performance path, right? And we're strength coaches, and that's generally my background. But the book and the message for, again, I'm just calling them high performance sport in general. It's PTs, it's athletic trainers, it's dietitians, it's sports psychologists, it's everybody, even sport coaches, anybody. The conventional path for people like us is degree, undergrad degree, master's degree, however many certifications you want to go after. There's countless options for them, maybe even go on to PhD work. Yeah, right. And a lot of times that, particularly for young, right, you this is less of the case as people work in sport a little bit longer, but particularly young professionals think that's the sole part of the formula to be really good. And as you get deeper into the game, you realize that it's definitely part of the formula. Our domain expertise and our knowledge, our core competencies and everything, that will always remain the foundation of what we do. I will never discount that part of it, but you have to balance the bar. That's kind of this term that I'm trying to do, get it out there, reduce the asymmetry. Let's recognize that these soft skills, the ability to communicate, like we talked about, to your coworkers and pass along information that is going to help them do their job better that day or that year or that semester. Communicate up to your bosses, be able to walk into an athletic director's office and package your message in a way that he will receive it well. And then when you pick up an intern, know how to communicate to them so that you help them grow and develop and empower them to be better than you someday. All of that stuff is necessary to have real impact in high performance sport. And it's the core message of the book. And that when you ask me what my goal was for even, putting pen to paper and everything, that's it. Because I personally know people that have gone two routes, really unbelievable, smart practitioners that maybe were a little bit deficient in these skills. And unfortunately and unfairly, they're looked past, right? Or maybe they're even fired, right? And they don't realize all their potential because they can't adapt to a new environment, or they don't communicate well to superiors and everything. And I know some of them, and it's unfortunate, but a lot of times they're casualties. Yep. And then you have the other ones too, right? You have some, by all standards, pretty average practitioners. Maybe they're not the smartest. Maybe they don't have the advanced degrees and everything, but they are amazing with athletes. They know how to connect, know how to communicate. They're unbelievable teammates, all that stuff. And a lot of times, if you spend enough time in high performance sport, those are the ones that last. They get more contracts, they get promotions, mm-hmm. right? So it speaks to the power of these skills and the power and the importance of recognizing that they should be a critical component of continuing education development efforts.
I can't that's perfect. That message is amazing, and it's something that needs to be screamed from the rooftops to every mm-hmm. undergrad kinesiology class that ever exists ever. It should probably be talked about, because God knows they all need to hear it. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times, and we've all, as young strength coaches, gone around and traveled, right? We go to the big time program, the big time school, or whatever you're going to, NBA, NFL, wherever you want to go learn from the best coach. And a lot of times you come away from that and you're kind of underwhelmed. And it's usually because of one of those two things. Either you think you're smarter than that coach, you're probably not as a GA or low level intern, but you think you are, or you see that they can't really communicate and coach and be with the person you want to be. So I think it's so important that you're bringing this up, because so many young coaches think that way. They have that kind of attitude and that ego that we all grow up with, right? Or most of us, at least. Mm-hmm. I'll say most of us, but they don't know how to. Exactly. And we don't know how to fix it though. So I think this is an important message, because if I walked into that same thing at 24, right, going to see an NFL team, and, you know, I had the opportunity to work for the Bears and the Browns. So just like you walking to the Eagles, where I was completely underqualified and completely out of my element, trying to understand how this 35-year-old man with three kids, who's a millionaire, how he and I can connect when I'm barely able to pay my rent. We have a very different set of lifestyles, and very difficult to have that. So knowing these soft skills would have been extremely important at that time. So I absolutely love that.
Sure.
And for those people who are listening, I mean, he basically takes a guy who's coming in as a GA. His name's Nathan Day. And he goes through his whole, like you said, upstream and downstream, and being able to go above him and talk to athletic directors and other coaches, talking to student athletes, talking to other people at the same level as other graduate assistants. It's just a really cool approach to this. And I really enjoy it. So
the experience of the fictional strength coach, right, Nathan Day, he happens to land at a university that has recognized the power of teaching these skills. And it's a fictional Division I university. And this character, Nathan, is in his very first week of a graduate assistant strength and conditioning coach job. And he is sent on this week-long special orientation program where he meets with a series of mentors that all teach him a different attribute. So again, I'll go back to kind of like previous in one of my answers, same soft skills. I did not invent these, right? Not at all. I would never take credit for that, right? It's the same bucket of skills that everybody, again, software engineering and, you know, medicine with respect to bedside manner and, you know, engineers and IT guys that are, you know, these companies are putting buckets and buckets of money into continuing education to help all of these people learn these types of skills, just pulled from that world, but repackaged it so that high performance sport people are like, cool, I get that. I remember going through that type of scenario. I did that, right? And I messed up that situation. So it's cool to see that kid did too, you know, like that kind of thing. Yeah. So he meets, you know, again, as part of this planned and designed, what I call in the book, week of guidance, he meets with these six different mentors that teach him a package of skills that will help him grow and develop into a highly impactful strength and conditioning coach. And again, it's a 1 week thing. And, certainly, like, even the theme of the book is like, hey, we're just getting started here. We're going to introduce you to these, but it's an opportunity to grow and develop as you progress through your 2 years here. And then maybe as you go on to whatever you do after this fictional graduate assistantship. So I like the story. I do. I like the way it came out. Of course, I'm going to endorse it because I wrote it, but I do believe the message. I went back and forth when I first kind of came up with the idea and everything. The original plan was a kind of traditional nonfiction professional development advice type book, like the countless ones we have on our shelves and all that stuff. And, you know, a lot of in-text citations and all of that stuff. And then, like, I had come off just reading another business parable that delivered a really cool message in a fiction form. And I'm like, wow, that would be really cool. And I think potentially even more impactful, because everybody loves the power of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And everybody learns a lot when you can place yourself and actually see practical situations. So that's what I did. And it was really fun. For the last 8 months, I just kind of sat in this basement here and, you know, came up with, number one, a lot of research. There is a lot of, and this was a pleasant discovery as I dug into it more, there's a lot of research in these soft skills that I had no idea. A lot of research on communication and, you know, self-awareness and cultural awareness. And then you dig into like all the papers that have been written on like professionalism and even some really good stuff from our world, like the NSCA and, you know, physical therapy organizations and everything, because everybody wants to prepare their young professionals, right? And wants to teach them to be good, respected pros. And they've actually published research around it and everything. So that was the research component of it, right? And then you just take a lot of stories from people that I know in my travels for 20 years of doing this, and then maybe like little variations of stuff that I went through myself and everything, and you start telling practical stories and drawing analogies to stuff that actually happens in team sport environments. And I hope that combination becomes a package that people want to take in and actually say, yeah, you know what? This is something that is, I should dig into this a little bit more and find ways to, number one, experience and maybe grow them for myself, because then I can become a more powerful, impactful practitioner. But also, as it's probably directed more towards young professionals than older, instill in my young employees and people that were just getting out of our internships and everything too, that we need to grow this stuff too, that it's not just about taking the next certification or weekend course or adding more letters, alphabet soup, like you said, but let's work on ways that we can grow these things too. And maybe think creatively. Like again, I just came up with like this fictional orientation week, but maybe that does spur some people that try to start thinking of different ways that they could grow these things in their own environments. I would love to hear some stories about that if that happens.
No, so even the way you've explained it to me, I would love to see someone actually take this and do it for real. So I've worked with a few universities and some people at universities, both I say work with universities as an athletic department and then, you know, a senior administrator or a head director of performance kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we've done these kind of ideas. I've helped build this type of, you know, coming from pure the HR side, you know, talent management, talent acquisition, right? So how do you acquire talent and then how do you develop them? And one of the things was, you know, how do you actually teach people? Well, one, do you have anything to teach? So going through the process, writing down, researching, formulating your philosophy, formulating your ideas. It's funny. So your book, you went to the next step that I didn't. So in mine, my sections were, you know, about me, kind of who am I, about leading yourself, about leading others. And then a whole, you know, I kind of look at my book as like, hey, the first three sections, anybody can read. The last section, if you're not using physiology as a mechanism to drive someone's performance, it's not for you. Because I pulled it all out. So I kept my lateral side in the front and then the specific side in the back. But everything you're saying, if you don't know how to do those things, if you're not actively being taught them, if you're not even recognizing that you need someone teaching you that stuff, then you're so far behind the eight ball. So I would love, like I said, I would love to see this book people take as they're reading it now, leverage it and be like, let's actually do that. Let's do a week. You know, let's find a different person in every department and let's actually do this idea. So kudos to you for putting it together in not only a tangible way that people can read, but something I think people could actually act on and create.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, I'll say it again. If even one high performance sport organization kind of takes this and is like, oh, that's cool. Let's try to do that. That would be really cool. I would love to hear that or some version of it. Or as we all do, you steal the idea and then you tweak it and you make it your own. And maybe they create some other version of a high level training program, but the focus is on this part of it and not so much just, you know, sitting somebody down in a training room and going over like how, you know, what is our protocol for musculoskeletal screening, right? And which is again a very important. You need to do that, but not only do that. Let's also talk about how we connect with athletes and how we get athletes to come in on time for their treatments. And then once they're here, that they're not so, you know, bored out of their minds. That we have a productive and fun and energetic environment that they actually like coming into this training room. And then find ways that we can go above and beyond to connect through compassion and empathy. And, you know, that they leave this training room and they're like, these people actually care about every part of me, because that's how you have real impact. Right.
No,
couldn't agree more. And yeah, sorry not to cut you off, Joe, but I felt really good about my internship program that I used to run back when I did, you know, college. And now I feel terrible about it. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take you through the big three questions that we ask everybody at the end. Okay. And I'm going to let Joe go first.
So as Matt mentioned, this is kind of our way to kind of hone in every conversation we have, right? So we always hit these three and then that way we can kind of compare and contrast and, you know, see what people come up with. So first one, what it's two-parter. How do you find balance? But first, what is balance for you? So define it in your world, and then how do you find it?
Yep. Really good and powerful question to start off with, for sure. I'm an early morning guy, and my mornings always start with, I can't say it starts with the same thing, but it starts with the most important thing for the day. And it isn't always my workout. Like, for a long time, I was a 6 a.m. workout guy. I'm not that anymore. So in my, you know, constantly flux and, you know, altering, like, what is the priority for today or the next 3 days or so, I'll start my morning early. I'm usually out of bed 5:30 at the latest. I'll get going at 6. I run, get my coffee. I'm probably at my desk doing my thing by 6. And whatever the most important thing I know I need to do that day, I'm doing it first before the day really gets going. And sometimes it is my workout, right? But other times, you know, for a long time in the last 8 months, it was making sure I wrote a couple chapters, right? Or got my 1500 words in for that day, right? It just, it changes all the time. Tomorrow it might be something different, but I knock that out first. And then I have a sense of, you know, you start your day with a sense of accomplishment, for sure. And that, to me, starts off balance, right? That's the accomplishment side. I know each day, now go to the balance side, which for me right now, in this stage of my life right now, is almost all centered around my son and making sure that I engage with him on some type of meaningful level when I see him in the afternoons, right? When he gets back from school. So I know coming up that I have my day, and it might be full of phone calls or emails or computer work and everything, but that shuts down when I go and I pick him up. And that time is dedicated to him. And that's my family element, right? And that to me is the yang to the yin of all the business stuff you're doing. And he gets pretty much my undivided attention for the most part. And what we do that day, again, it could be homework related, it could be reading, it could be going out, you know, baseball's about to start. So, you know, we could be going out and throwing the ball and all that stuff. But family is the other side that enables me. When you ask me what is my definition of balance, of course, work-wise is all tied to the projects that I'm working on. And, you know, now it's marketing a book and all that stuff and some other little side consultancy stuff I'm doing. But the other side to that balance for me, my joy goes to the family side, centered around my son and, you know, the home that I'm living in and all that stuff too. So that's a big one.
Nice. Very nice. Hey, how old's the little guy?
Is about to turn 10 in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yep.
Double
yep.
digits.
Woo. Yep. Yep.
Well, yeah, you were saying reading, homework, you know, I figured a little older. I got 5-year-old and a 2-year-old and then a third one on the way. So
those are fun ages. And yeah. And congrats. That's awesome.
Thanks. Yeah. No, me and Matt are in that early stage parental development chaos. Yeah. We got little ones.
Chaos is a
word for it too.
I was just about to say the exact same
thing. I only have one. You're going to go to 3, right? That's the, you know, it's cliche, but now you can't go man to man anymore, right? Now you got to go.
Nope. Hey. Boss lady makes the calls. I just signed the checks, man.
Okay. Hey, right. Say no more.
Jesse, question number 2.
Yep.
What is the best investment you've ever made for either yourself as a human being or your business or as an author? What was the best investment you ever made for under $500 and then under $1,000?
Oh, wow. Really good question that I'm completely unprepared for. Huh. If I go over 5, wait, so I answer both under 5 and over 5?
We'll let you go either way. I feel like you're struggling with this one. We'll give you a lifeline.
I am struggling a little bit. I'm not going to lie.
This one always gets people.
Yeah. The computer has opened up so many opportunities, right? And a lot of them, like, not just, you know, it's like learning. Like, all of a sudden you sit down and you got a bunch of courses you're taking online. And again, some of it went to the book. I had no clue how to write a novel or get a book done. And, you know, all of a sudden there's an online course on how to find a guy that will format the inside of a book and all that stuff, and, you know, everything. So to me, the computer nowadays, with just the opportunity to learn and just all of the amazing resources out there in anything you want to grow in, that to me is the best investment these days, like some type of technology piece that helps someone that wants to grow and develop do that. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Final question. Who coaches you?
Right now, again, I'll go back to family. I'll go to my son. I learned something from him all the time. Here's what's really funny. The first time I coached one of his teams, it was actually the only time to this point, although I'm about to become his soccer team speed consultant, which is going to be really fun, right? That actually starts tomorrow, as a matter of fact. But I coached one of his flag football teams when he was five and had done no coaching with children, no sport coaching with children, right? Go back to my clinic days. I did a ton of like speed and agility work with kids, but no sport coaching with children up to that point ever in my life, right? And, you know, I had no reason to. And oh my gosh, you talk about communication and like packaging your message to you know, in a way that the people that need to receive it can. I had no clue how to coach kids. None. Like I was, you know, and everybody, you know, they know your background. Oh, this guy works in the NBA. He must be great and everything. I was a miserable failure coaching five-year-olds in flag football. I couldn't get it. You know what I mean? Like it's just a totally different world in coaching and getting five-year-olds and to try to do and execute the ins and outs of flag football and everything. I don't know if I ever caught a stride. You know how like usually it's like, oh yeah, and then after a couple of weeks I caught my stride. I don't think I did. I think I did those five-year-old a disservice all year long. I really do. But I say that because now at like 9 and 10, of course, as dads, like you go out and you're trying to coach your kids. And right now we're like working on his jump shot a little bit. And, you know, you find different ways that you don't want to be overbearing. You don't want to be that dad that comes from working in sports. And you're like, no, we got to practice every day. We got to do it this way. And it's got to be technique perfect and everything. Like nobody, you know, kids don't want to hear that from their dad. So anyway, we go back and forth all the time. And I actually allow him to make a lot of decisions on what we do with like sports and everything. It's like, what do you want to do today, buddy? Right. And, you know, I'll get my coaching hat on in some elements, but through all of that, with how a 9 and 10 year old like kind of wants to learn and grow and everything. And even when it ventures outside of sports, he teaches me a lot. And I adjust my approach based on that. A lot of what I learned from him.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm. Very solid answer for sure. So I'm going to throw a fourth question at you. I'm a real jerk for doing this, but my big question here is what advice would you give for young strength coaches, right? That's kind of who you push this book towards and somebody you think you could really grow for is one of the things you said. So what's your big piece of advice that you recommend?
Yeah, there's a bunch of them, but what I would say, and I'm positive most young strength coaches or, you know, high performance pros have heard this, but the circle that you surround yourself with is so critically important to your development. And I'll say that again, right? And, you know, some people say, you know, you're the average of the five people you're around. Whatever message you want to hear, the people you spend the most time with, including family, have so much of an influence on who you become. They really do. And it works both ways. If you're hanging around with a bunch of turds and negative people and, you know, people that are, you know, infighting and backstabbing and all that stuff, even if you aren't that person, you might end up being that person, right? Because you end up like kind of doing what people do around you. It's just human nature. But the other way is really powerful, right? Get some people and have some balance, identify people, you know, identify some smart people that really want to help you grow in whatever it is your world is, if it's strength and conditioning, or if it's physical therapy, return to play or something, like hang out with somebody that's really good at that. And you're going to learn a lot, right? Just from hanging out with them. And if you want to identify soft skills and everything, find somebody that's pretty good at that, like a really good people person that has great relationships with athletes, and people are walking into that office, seeking them out for questions and asking them to be participate on teams and everything. That's a pretty good indication that that person has that skill set nailed. And if you can balance yourself out with like five or six people that you spend real time with regularly, you got a really good shot of developing a diverse skill set to be somebody to reckon with. And I think that's really important.
Beautiful, man. That is the perfect way to close, because that's, again, we've all heard it. Like you said, we've all heard it in different ways, but that's a message that people need to hear constantly day after day. Yeah. And it's changed my life. I mean, I literally took that to heart about 10 years ago, and consciously made the choice to think about who I'm around, how they act, and do I want them around? Mm-hmm. And it literally, my career trajectory, life trajectory, family trajectory is just like this.
I'm going to call crap on that, because you're still hanging out with me, Joe. So clearly doesn't matter that much. You know what I mean? Like, you could have very easily just cut that right out, dude.
That's why we do this at night once every other week or two. You're a small percentage, bud. Small percentage.
I've been called small so many times. This is just real hurtful right now. Jesse, you've been an absolute pleasure to have on. As soon as you said you were interested in coming on, we were definitely excited to have you. So I'm definitely glad you took the time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you guys having me on. Glad I can help and deliver the message and answer your questions. This was fun, so thank you.
Absolutely. Last thing, can you tell us where to buy the book?
Yeah, you can just do a search on Amazon, right? So that's where it is, right? We went through the Amazon platform. And then also you can find more information on generally everything that we talked about here on balancethebar.com.
Amazon KDP, love them. Awesome. Amazon,
there you go. That's an amazing resource for anyone that wants to kind of do something creative. Yeah, really good.
Nope, that's where I did mine, and I recommend it to everyone. That's the best way to do it. All right, last one. Social media. I know you said Amazon's for the book. Balance the Bar is the website. Social media handles, LinkedIn. Where do people find you in the web outside of the website?
Yep. I really only read Twitter. I don't think I've ever tweeted. My biggest social media platform is Instagram, Jesse K. Wright, right? JesseKWright. And then that's the same thing on LinkedIn as well. Jesse K. Wright. You can find me there.
Cool. Awesome, sir.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you guys. This was fun.
Appreciate it, Jesse. Have a great night, bud.
Yep.
See you.